This is Brian Peckford.
This is Danielle Smith.
This is Glenn Healy.
Hey, everybody. This is Paul Brandt.
This is Dr. Peter McCullough.
Hi, everyone. This is Jamie Soleil, and welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, folks. Happy Friday. Woo! Love me a good Friday. Anyways, I hope you're enjoying it. We got a good one on tap for you today. Now here, before I get into anything else, Susan's giving away a free copy of her book. So in order to enter, it is August 12th today, and we'll leave it open until August 19th, a full week, okay? Friday to Friday. If you're hearing this part as you listen, all you got to do is in the show notes, my number's there, text me your name and where you're currently listening to the podcast from. If they're creative, colorful answers, you never know. They may get posted because I like to have a little bit of fun, as I know all of you fine folks like having fun as well. So if you're wanting a copy of Susan Stanfield's Betrayed book, free of charge, all you got to do, name and where you're currently listening to the Sean Newman podcast, just text it to me. It's all in the show notes, and we'll see. We'll have a little fun here for the next week. You know, for me on this side, it has been a busy week. Monday night started with the candidates roundtable. You know, that was the 300th episode. Well, that happened Monday night. That was a whirlwind. Then the next day I was down to Calgary and got to, you know, go see the Western Standard and meet up with Theo Fleury and Canadians for Truth and see their impressive facility. They're beginning down that path. And I think as, you know, as the months progress, we'll hear more and more about that. So it's been a busy week. I hope wherever you are certainly having a little bit of fun, enjoying what we have of the summer weather. I hate to even say that. I mean, it's only August, but you get the point. It just seems like it's cruising along. No time flat. It'll be hockey and everything else back on the go if it hasn't already started for you. For some, it maybe have never stopped. Either way, we got a cool one on tap for you today. And of course, we got to get to our episode sponsors. I should have bothered Stephen Barber while I was down in Calgary. I didn't even think about it until I got back in the studio. It was a little bit of a holy moly, hold on to your pants here as we flew down there and back. Anyways, since 2017, if you don't know who Stephen Barber is, well, he's the owner of Upstream Data. He was back on episode 163, and I'm hoping to get him back on here at some point. He's been pioneering creative solutions for vented and flared natural gas at Upstream oil and gas facilities, you know, with Bitcoin miners. And I got to do a little bit of work in their facility here in Lloyd. It's been interesting to watch, and I'm no expert on it. That's why we need to get Stephen back in and have him talk some more about it, because, I mean, how many people do you know that are doing that? I certainly don't know that many. Whether we're talking about the Bitcoin mining or some of the shacks and the little modular units they got, I think that's what they're calling them. Like, you can put it in your, you know, at your house, your garage. I know people using it to heat their garage. You can put them in your barn, of course, your oil field site, your commercial site, all that good stuff. Just go to upstreamdata.ca to find out more and see some of the products they're coming out with, because it's super cool. And honestly, there's a lot to be learned there. RecTech Power Products, for over 20 years, they've been committed to excellence in the power sports industry. As the summer cruises along, whether you're, you know, maybe you're looking to upgrade or trade in or buy brand new, well, they offer Can-Am, Ski-Doo, Sea-Doo, Spyder, Mercury, Evinrude, Mahindra, Roxer, and I know how I am on those machines. I'm a little bit rough, and that's where their parts department can hook you up with any maintenance or upgrades that you need. They're open Monday through Saturday. For further details, visit them at rectechpowerproducts.com. HSI Group, they're the local oil field burners and combustion experts that can help make sure you have a compliant system working for you. The team also offers security, surveillance, and automation products for residential, commercial, livestock, and agricultural applications. They use their technology to give you peace of mind so you can focus on the things that truly matter. Stop in today, 3902 52nd Street, or give Brody your Kim a call at 306-825-6310. Gartner Management, they're a Lloyd Mister based company specializing in all types of rental properties to help meet your needs. Whether you're looking for an office such as myself, or maybe you got multiple employees, you need a little bigger space, give way to call 780-808-5025. Now, let's get on to that tale of the tape brought to you by Hancock Petroleum. For the past 80 years, they've been an industry leader in bulk fuels, lubricants, methanol, and chemicals, delivering to your farm, commercial, or oil field locations. For more information, visit them at hancockpetroleum.ca. She has lived and worked all over the world. Her justice advocacy is inspired by her professional backgrounds in American television, travel, photography, and human rights training. She started the No More Lockdowns protest in April 2020 in Vancouver. I'm talking about Susan Stanfield. So buckle up. Here we go.
Hi, my name's Susan Stanfield, and welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Susan Stanfield. So first off, thank you for hopping on.
Yeah, what an honor to be here and speak to you. Thank you.
And I got to say, I appreciate you sending me your book, Betrayed. So if anyone is wanting to get the full story on you and everything else, yes, she has a copy of it there sitting there. Man, it's a lot, and I hope we get to do it justice today and talking a lot about your story and, you know, leaving Canada and everything else. But regardless, thanks for sending me a copy. And to anyone who wants to buy one, Susan, let's start off there. Where can they go to help support you and learn more about your story? We'll top it at the end as well, so that if they forget it right now, they can remember.
Okay, awesome. Well, I'll make it quick. I always like to give away books. So if you would like to pick somebody through some comment or whatever, I will send them a free book just as a fun thing by the end of tonight, or you just send me their message. My best deal is 3 books for $100. And I promote this because you can literally save money. And usually when one person's reading it, they have a friend or a brother or sister. So it's on my site, healthjusticetees.com. You can buy one book or you can take advantage of this special. And the reason why it's cheaper is there's the shipping numbers get better when it hits 3. When it hits 4 and 5, then the shipping numbers go up again. But I'm basically in the shipping business now. So that's where it is. And like I said, I love giving freebies, discounts, whatever. The most important thing is for me is that people get this in their hands across Canada, because it is an evidence bundle. And a lot of us are producing evidence bundles in some way, but I haven't seen something that is a print version like this. So I'm sending this to lawyers and judges and courts. I'm sending it all over the place for different reasons. There's a lot of ways you can use the book. So thanks for the plug.
Yeah, you betcha. Well, I appreciate you coming on and giving me some of your time. You talk about an evidence bundle. I was literally just talking about this with a friend. There was a video that came out, geez, I don't know, 2-3 weeks ago. Maybe it's even less than that. And it's a woman just talking about the first year. And then the second year and what's continuing to go on. You're like, God, you almost black out part of the time frame, because there's been so much go on. But when you put it in a form that you can just easily read it or listen to it or what have you, you go, holy crap, we've gone through a lot in the last 2 years. And you, ma'am, are a lady who's certainly experienced more than her fair share. So the book is wonderful. I will tell listeners that, but maybe let's just start. I want to go back something early on in the book. You leave Canada, or maybe it's later on in the book. I can't remember now. You leave Canada for the first time in 2005. Before we ever get to COVID, I'm really curious in your background, Susan, because you have a really interesting perspective that I think the listeners would love to hear about. What drives you to leaving Canada in 2005? And if you want to start a little bit before there, by all means, take the helm.
Yeah, no, that's thank you for asking this, because I grew up in the sort of the have side of Canada, right? I didn't come from a wealthy family or anything, but I was educated at Queen's, one of the best schools, good jobs. I was always opportunity. So someone like me could have had the best of Canadian society, right? I grew up in the 70s. I grew up in the 80s. I'm 54. And so there wasn't much someone like me wouldn't be able to have as an opportunity. Not many barriers, right? You know, healthy, you know, did sports, had friends, stuff like that. But in around the late 80s, I started feeling Canada changing. And I started reading alternative magazines like Mother Jones and stuff. And I remember specifically when it happened. It was in like 87 or 91 or something. Halliburton entered Canada. And I remember reading the story and thinking, this isn't good. And I didn't know much about the military industrial complex and conspiracy, big crime rings and everything that we see now. But I was like, this isn't Canada. And I started seeing it change, because I grew up in the 70s. I remember the 70s vividly, right? And I think they were our most beautiful, pristine decade. And I say that in respect to our Indigenous people, because it was never great for them. So that's a whole other story. But And so I started watching it.
What was it about the 70s?
Well, we were still, I think, and I'm a layperson when it comes to this, but we were still sort of riding the freedom of the 60s, this open liberal thing. People had money. The first big recession hadn't hit my generation. It hit in the end of the 70s. And my mother didn't have to work, right? We owned a home in a nice neighborhood. The broad-based wealth trajectory was still going up for the average Canadian. And I'm not saying every single person, and certainly not the Indigenous, but for the average middle-class family, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, everybody was still going up. And towards the 80s, that's when it started stalling. Because I believe, or I call it this way, this foreign collusion started capturing our country. And I could see it in little ways. I worked for American television companies. I was very astute, like you, around the media. I was watching things change. And through the 90s, I just got really depressed. And I was like, I'm not going to be successful here. Every road that I wanted to go down to do the things that I wanted to do in my way didn't seem like an option. You know, even a perfect example, like it didn't seem like I could be a mom that would raise kids at home. I would have to have some job and struggle, and life would be stressful. I could just see it, the stress. I started seeing the urban decay. I started seeing the pollution. When I was a kid, we used to go pick clams near our beach in West Point Grey in Vancouver. It's a beach everybody knows. All the clams disappeared, you know, the environmental pullback, all that. And so I would say the 90s became the beginning of what I think is now is rot, you know, chemicals, corruption, poverty. I mean, the poverty is off the charts now compared to the 70s. So I just wanted out. I thought, I don't know if this is it for me. And I wanted to go to see the absolute opposite, and I wanted to go live in Africa. So I started traveling there and working there part-time and whatever, and then I finally just left completely in 2005. I didn't see a future for myself in Canada. I didn't feel valued. I didn't feel like everything all my friends were doing and stuff. I was like, I don't really want to do those things. Mostly I wanted to travel. I was looking for adventure, but I left Canada again last year for the exact same reasons, that we live in an occupied nation, basically, that's run by big, powerful cartels, and we fight them every day. I mean, look at your phone bill. Nobody in the world pays the rates that Canadians pay. It's not a fair, it is not a fair society. Children's rights are in the toilet. It's unequal. It's becoming less equal every year. So I'm happy to be able to live in other places because I don't have the childhood memories of, oh, it was a wonderful country. When you're around brokenness in other people's countries, it's less painful because you don't have to compare it to the way it was when you were younger. You know, we have a lot of depression in North America and Canada, a lot of people on drugs.
Yeah. When it comes to depression and drugs, that type of thing, would you equate it then to, because I mean, you lived in Africa and other parts of the world. It was over a decade, was it not? So yeah. You've seen different cultures, different experiences, that type of thing. When it comes to North America, Canada, what sticks out to you then after you went away and you come back? I mean, you talk about chemicals and different things like that, but when you come back and you see people doing what they're doing now, what was the biggest shock to your system of like, holy crap, that isn't good?
Okay, it's very simple. And I'm not trying to be provocative or, you know, a loudmouth, whatever, but I believe this is the fact. Canadians have become completely controlled by the government. And they don't understand that. They don't understand that they have handed over their opinions, their thoughts, their behaviors. They believe we've been raised and taught to believe our governments are benevolent, and they are not. And they are hurting so many Canadians, but Canadians won't fight for themselves. The number of people that said to me, if I wouldn't wear a mask in a store, just follow the rules. And I was like, where are these people getting this? Why are they not saying, I'm not going to follow them. I'm not going to let the government tell me what to do. And so I think that's why Canada is suffering so much more than other countries, is people have really handed over their rights, their freedoms, and even their dignity. They've handed it over to the government, and we've become like a nanny state. That's what they call Britain, the nanny state. We've become a nanny welfare state where we think, well, we'll turn to the government and they'll solve everything for us. I mean, look how many people are employed by our government. A million people work for the federal government, apparently.
Hmm.
That's what it is. And the average, sorry, I'll just say one more thing. The average Canadian has never lived outside Canada, let alone lived in a completely opposite culture like I have. Maybe they lived in California or something, right? And they don't know. And they don't know any different. And they particularly don't understand how controlling the media is and how much fraud there is in our media.
Well, coming from a... I'll stick on your first point here about trusting the government. Is partly that to do with a relative newness, and I say that lightly, as a country, and the fact that we've, you know, minus First Nations, and I don't mean to go like minus First Nations. I've certainly started to open up a bit more of a dialogue there and understand that they've been living it for hundred plus years, right? Like this isn't so. Please take that with a little bit of respect. I don't mean to try and just slide that by, but
no, you're right. It's a
but overall, yeah. But overall society in Canada, for the most part, going along with what the government has done up until this point, has been for the most part pretty advantageous of most people. Or am I wrong on that?
No, that's the key. That's the kicker. So we didn't have as many problems until the 80s, and so people didn't really notice it. Life was great. You didn't really notice it. Like my mother was killed. I say this because this is the truth. I'm strong language, but she was killed by Quebec shareholders, Imperial Tobacco, their cartel, public health. They lied to Canadians for decades about cigarettes. And so she was a victim of that. I lost her when I was young because of that. But very few people had experienced that. Very few people were sick. But it was still the same cartel. Like Canada is one of the most corrupt countries, but you don't see it because the average person's more people were moving up into the middle class, whereas you would notice it in Africa because more people would be poor. Africa is moving now more up into the middle class, and now Canada is moving down, and we were getting more poor. And I started seeing that. I would fly back 2 or 3 times a year, right? And I would see things happening here that weren't happening in Africa anymore, that we were getting poorer and as Africa was getting wealthier.
So Canada is more corrupt than Africa.
Well, no, that's a big, broad statement, but look how big, like we have some of the biggest reserves of natural resources in the world. The people do not govern that. No way. All this stuff is bought and sold off to cartels. There is no, look at the indigenous people back again, right? Look what they go through fighting for their land. So the broadness of it, it's bigger because it's a bigger nation, Africa. You know, you cut it all up into small countries. And of course, it's more corrupt in places like Congo, where they're killing children and using them as slaves in the mines. You know, that's not happening in Canada. But the systemic accepted status quo establishment of how the corruption works. Like I was at a fundraiser at a very wealthy family's house, and this counselor was there, an elected official was there. And I said, you should pass a law where you let people sell food on the streets like they do in Asia and Africa and stuff. Like nice little tents. Like this is how you broad-based uplift people, giving them access to earn a bit of income every day, right? And that's how I could sell my food, because I can't afford to rent a store and a lease and taxes. And that's not a play for the average mom, right? You can't make that move. But I could open up a little stall and make a few $100 every day, and I could get on my way, and I could start that way. And that's broad-based upliftment. And he said, yeah, but you know, then it wouldn't be fair to my 3 restaurants. And that's what we're up against. And he works for the government. And so you will never see these policies. That's why we don't have street vendors, because the cartels, and I'm not trying to sound like some big, you know, haunted monster, but they run the show in Canada. Big grocery stores, big liquor stores, lobby groups, military contractors. Like we don't notice it because we're in this beautiful country where we're free. But you start digging into how all of these decisions and these economies and these companies work. Is the average Canadian have any money anymore? Do we have any wealth, or do we just have debt? We've got debt and we're sick. Of 36 million Canadians, how many are going upward and will live a better life in the next 10 years? I don't think it's a majority.
I would guess it's not the majority.
So why? It's Canada, it's 2022. Why are we getting poorer and sicker?
Well, few I got to live in Finland. I've brought this up multiple times, but I got to live in Finland while playing hockey. And one of the things that just astounded me about their culture was fast food. Like, it's non-existence. Right. Don't get me wrong, in Helsinki and I believe Tampere, there was, you know, your staples, McDonald's and a couple things like that. But where I was at in Rahe, there was like no fast food. And I should say there was fast food, but it was homemade fast food, right? So it's not the same thing.
They don't have the big chains there? They don't have all the big chains?
Well, they do in the major center, like Helsinki for sure will. But as you go out of the major city, and maybe this has changed. This is, you know, this is a decade ago. It certainly could have changed. But when I was there, I was like, hey, man, this is like really interesting. You wanted to, you know, you go to the bar at night, Susan, and you come out looking for your whatever fix. There was like vendors set up and they were making you fresh pizza. And I'm like, that's kind of cool, right? Like, where else do you get that? You don't get that in Lloydminster. You go to, you know, your McDonald's or whatever.
That's the result of policy. That is the result of policy, motivating good things for the average person and unmotivating bad things, right?
Well, I think somewhere here, the best chance, this is your words out of your book, the best chance at a long, happy life derives from healthy food, exercising, sleeping well, pursuing meaningful endeavors, and having strong, healthy relationships. I read that. I highlighted it. I put it down. I'm like, so this is what we've all been talking about now, at least my side for the last year, is why doesn't a government say those things? Exactly. That right there, you know, you talk about the average Canadian isn't probably going to get ahead in the next decade. Well, part of that's education as well, right? We don't talk about owning every last thing and being so far in debt and having a $1 million house and all these things, how hard of a burden that is to get out from under and how much stress that does to one and what stress does to the body and everything else. Right. And then you top it off that we can get fast food on every, like, I don't know of a society quite like North America. And I lump US and Canada
come over
together.
Come over here. It's UK. It's actually worse in England.
Really?
Well, big
Susan, you cut out on me. I can't hear you.
I can hear you.
Oh, there you are again.
Oh, okay.
So wait, the UK is worse. Why is the UK worse?
Okay, because they say 65, but I think I've also been told there's 90 million people here on the size of a piece of land that's like Vancouver Island.
Yeah.
And so the density and the margins, the cost of doing business is cheaper here. It's cheaper for me to send you a book than for you to send a book to Saskatchewan. My book costs almost three times as much sending it within Canada than it does for me to there. Everything is cheaper here because of the economies of scale. So you can't go anywhere without seeing junk food, sugar, chemicals, crap. The UK is, I think, the second or third. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. I think UK is the second or third most obese nation in the world.
Oof.
Yeah. And like two thirds of the country is overweight. One third is obese. It's really, really bad here. Maybe not in little pockets of London and stuff, but the stuff is everywhere. And the Brits have taken to it because they didn't have it earlier on the way we did. A lot of the stuff is new. McDonald's is newer for them, right? They love it. McDonald's is everywhere. People love it. And they're like, oh, this is great. We don't have to stay home and make these pies like we used to. So it's all policy. Like, I was on a call to try and launch an alcohol reduction campaign for women. And the woman was a very high level provincial politician insider. And she said that they had just licensed 300 new liquor store retail type outlets, you know, places where you could buy alcohol in Ontario. At the same time, the experts and the medics and people like Theresa Tam, she even talks about this, they know that alcohol is the second or third leading cause of cancer in Canada. So why are they offering licenses for more alcohol? Because the alcohol lobby in Ontario is so powerful. That's where all the brewers are. And she said, we can't stop it. They lobby the government so much that we're forced to comply to them because they're going to pay taxes, they're going to employ people. So they opened 300 new liquor stores knowing those are basically cancer depots. It's all policy. And you get people in government who don't fight for it or get incentivized or whatever, then forget it. Nobody at the beginning of the pandemic told us to exercise or eat fruit salad. Nobody. Nobody in government.
I don't know if I've ever heard the Alberta SAS government to this point bring up those points. Think about that.
Yeah, because right? It doesn't pay. It doesn't pay for them.
To have a healthy, long term, it would it not? I just think long term, if your population was healthy, motivated, less negativity, blah 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 blah. Your healthcare system would see an uptick from that. I would think there'd be.
It wouldn't motivate them financially. They benefit more by us being sick because they get the money from the companies that are making us sick. They would have a better Canada, but they're not going to have more money in their bank account. And that's the problem. And that's really what I think started in the late 80s was this, the money part came in and people started taking money.
How much is enough money?
Well, sadly, like the guy that ran Jerry Diaz, who ran Unifor, he was the president of Unifor. Apparently, he did it. He forced PPE and did that whole sort of racketeering.
And then took a bribe.
It was only $50,000, apparently.
Yeah. So yeah. Me and Tuz on one of our segments, we talk about that story. I'm like, I mean, if you're going to take a bribe, at least take like a couple million bucks or I don't know. Like, I don't even know. But the thing is, with that story, Susan, you go, that ain't the first bribe he's ever taken. There's no way he just went one day right at the end of his career. You know, I'll take 50,000 and be on my way.
Well, and I was told all the city councils are doing it. My friend of mine, I should say, worked in development, and the city councilors basically like, okay, we need more money, and they would just milk it until they had the money they wanted from developers. So sadly, I mean, not all of them are bad people, but the model has become broken that a city council hasn't figured out how to generate enough revenue to pay its costs. So it is almost in a way forced to take bribes to pay the bills. And they're not all lining their pockets. Some of them are very good people. So the model is broken and it's just the sludge of bureaucracy. You know, the older Canadians will talk about that. How much bigger our governments are. We don't need these governments that are so big. They do everything for us now. It's ridiculous. And especially for someone like me, because I don't interact with the government at all. I don't use anything they do. I'm all private sector and minimal and stuff. So I just think I hear the number of people that they do this at the government and then they go to the hospital and they're constantly, it's almost like they interact with the government on a daily basis. It's become normal for them.
Yeah. A little bit of being spoon fed, so to speak. Well, take me back then.
The welfare state. Yeah.
Yeah. Take me back to April 12th, 2020, because you know, what I was saying to you before we started was like, I was a year, you know, I remember a bunch of this. But I was still in the state of like, no, it's not going to be that bad, you know, and I was like, denial. Then it was, you know, I mean, our group met, I think the first time we got together in a barn was right before Christmas 2020. I think it was December. A group of rural people got together at a barn and had a conversation about what on earth is going on. Well, I go back, you know, even as I read it, I'm like, man, April 12, 2020, like that was early. Like that is about as fast as you can go. And you had the no more lockdowns protest.
Yeah. And we all knew we were talking about it for a month before then too, right? We're all going, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Well, so your question, do you want me to explain why me and why that protest, what happened in that month?
Yeah, absolutely. Honestly, Susan, I think for a lot of people, your name has come up an awful lot with a bunch of my listeners. So they obviously know exactly who you are. But there's going to be a whole bunch of people that are, you know, as we're going along here, they're like, oh, she started the no more lockdowns. Okay. Well, I'm just curious about the story leading up to it and however much you want to fill in with us. So yeah, for sure. All of it.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you that it's the story this way because it will help a lot of people. So I've studied social justice movements and leaders and things like that for years, like all over the world in history for hundreds of years. I've studied the big ones, right? And profiled how they work and who led them and whatever. And usually, well, almost always, a person who becomes a significant pivotal leader in a movement or for anything, or successful, say a successful entrepreneur, anybody who kind of shoots up and becomes the first early spokesperson is typically a person who has more information than all the other people, just by chance. they have this, they have this, they have this, they have all seven bits. It's like you're into sports. You know, with baseball, the stars are the guys that can do all four things. They can hit, run, catch, and throw. Right? They can do all four. The team will take a guy that can only do one, but you want the guys that can do all four. So I just happened to have all four of those pieces of the puzzle. It just happened to be, it was chance. I had a really strong media background, so I knew fraud when I saw it on TV. I knew the British Columbia government was completely captured by pharmaceuticals. I knew that Bonnie Henry was not a good person for us because of other legislation I discovered 2 years earlier. And I had been lobbying politicians for a couple of years already to change something in my school, and they all ignored me. So when I sat there and watched it, I was like, this is exactly what I've been talking about for 2 years. I just happened to be that person that had all those four pieces. Nobody had seen this legislation that I had seen that Bonnie created. Nobody had heard of it. It was really injurious. It was threatening to fine parents $250,000 and put them in jail for 6 months if you didn't give the government your kids' vaccine records at school. And I was like, what kind of a politician creates this crap? I had no idea these things existed. So I went to see my member of the Legislative Assembly, totally blew me off. And I was like, I smell a rat. Something's going on in BC. Not thinking it was ever going to bother me because I don't do any of this stuff and I'll just dodge them at the school PAC meetings or whatever. And then when the propaganda hit and the flags came out and Justin Trudeau was paraded out and they're all standing there, I was like, whoa, is this ever a psyop? And because I have an advertising background, you may appreciate this too. It was way too organized. And a lot of other early leaders said that too. It was way too prepared. If it had really been a natural emergency pandemic, they would have been scrambling and desperate and terrified. They had their signs ready. They had all the posters. They had the branding selected. That stuff takes months to prepare. So it was I was just that person that put it all together quickly. And I just bothered to get my ass off the couch and out the door with a bunch of signs and start screaming. And a lot of people knew what I knew, but they just didn't do that part. And so I did that part. And it just hit like a match to a bonfire. 4 million people saw our march and they saw it because everybody was starting to talk about it. And I was just one of the first people out yelling and marching with cameras.
Yeah, but even, you know, when you're planning for the first one, I don't know if you expected 50 people to come, 50,000 people to come, but I think the number was 18 plus yourself, 19 people walking on the streets. Now, me and you both can agree that is that's not even a drop in the bucket. That's like, you know, I mean, but it is a start. I will give you that. And then on top of that, the videos reaching millions, you're like, holy crap. Like, obviously some people were ready to see something that made sense. Were you deflated by the turnout, or were you like, you know what, this is where it's got to start? This is where it's got to start.
Well, I had underestimated the power of social media because I wasn't a social media influencer. I'm still a very small one. But Dan Dix was there, who was one of Canada's first big YouTubers for over 10 years. He's been doing it for 15 years. So he was with us. And so if he hadn't been with us and if he hadn't loaded his stuff up on YouTube and Twitter, maybe only a couple of thousand people would have seen it. It was because of Dan. I knew that people would take photographs or I would share my pictures, but I thought maybe 10 or 20,000 people will see us. I knew we didn't need hundreds of people with us in the march. We needed good signs because we were photographing them. We were going to try and use a bit of social media. But honestly, it was a good question. I arrived. I was disappointed there were only 18 people standing there. I was excited that anybody was there because nobody might have been there. I honestly had no idea what to expect, but I didn't invite anybody. My friend did because I didn't do that kind of stuff. She had the list. So just the fact that 18 people were there, I remember talking to them and thinking, okay, this is how we're going to start. And I was grateful that there weren't 500 people because I didn't have the skill to do that. It took me about 2 or 3 weeks to get to those numbers, to lead those numbers. And we had a fight. That fight broke out in our first march of 18 people. There was a fist fight on the corner of the street, and I was the one that had to kind of deal with it. So I went to the police right away and said, okay, listen, I'm starting protest marches, and I got to do this the right way. So what do I do? Come and teach me how. And then they started coming with us. So it was an interesting question. I was a little bit disappointed, but I was mostly terrified and really nervous. I was just trying to survive the first few hours and get home again without vomiting.
Well, and that would be, you know, now if there's a protest going on, when it comes to mandates, lockdowns, everything, there's just so much information now about most people are like, yep. Back then, that would not have been the case. When you talk about the fight breaking out on the corner, I mean, at that was like peak hysteria. That was like peak, like, holy crap.
Well, it wasn't even about COVID. It was about something else. A couple of guys just, you know, whatever. But you're right. You know, we were so vulnerable back then. We had nothing. We had no support. We had no numbers. We were really green. I had never done anything like this before. I had been involved with justice for 20 years, but not megaphones and stages and stuff. And now, you know, that's why I say, like, I played the role of the flak jacket, you know, that first battalion, the vanguard battalion that goes out and you take the biggest hits. Like, my character was assassinated. And I knew that would happen. And it's good that it's different now, because Canadians, we are not conditioned to believe it's socially acceptable to protest the government. I was frowned on by almost every single person I knew, saying, how can you do that? I mean, I think secretly they were like, go sue, right? And a lot of them told me that. But they were like, oh, I could never do that, right? But it's one of the most protective, smartest things you can do is speak out for yourself. But we're not encouraged to do that in Canada. We're encouraged to follow the status quo, fit in, don't cause problems, be polite, apologize, and that you'll just be taken care of.
And one of the, I had someone close to me say in the summer of 2021, to lose your trust in the government is a dangerous thing. You need to be careful. And I remember, I chewed on it for a long time, because I'm like, once you start seeing what's going on, it's hard not to see it going on. I think that's what he meant by it. Although I'm not so certain anymore, because I truly think he just wanted me to stay between the lines and not get, not go outside the lines, so to speak. And yet, like, to have blind faith in your government that it's not going to do anything wrong, especially after what we've seen in the last couple of years, I think about that often and go, I'm really glad I don't stop asking questions. That's one of your superpowers, so to speak, is your ability to see a situation, to not be, so many of us, I'm just going to go home. You know, I think of the park when they closed it down, Sue, on you. And instead of getting up like all the families,
yeah,
you sat there and just waited, just see what happened. Because it's like, well, nobody's come with, you know, guns and are hauling us off. Let's just see what's going on here, right? Yeah. I think those, for so many people, hearing about something or even seeing it on social media is one thing, but actually like being in a place and experiencing what is actually taking place and seeing things is so pivotal in any argument or any direction in life you're going to take. You need to see things firsthand. It's you talk about not enough Canadians leave the country, 100%. Not enough Canadians, you know, at this point have probably went to the border and just seen how hard it is to get across, because they've been told you're not allowed to. And I have no idea. I'm not here to sit and say everybody go race to the borders. I am here to say, you know, just because Justin Trudeau gets up on a stage and says one thing doesn't mean it translates to the rest of the human beings monitoring those borders the same way as what he just said. I mean, you need to go out and experience things in order to be fully informed. And that's one of the things I really took from your book. Your book really imparted that. I already kind of knew that, but like reading your story and how it gets outlined, I'm like, you need to be okay to like go into some situations that you, because 99% of Canadians, probably people, won't want to do that. Like, they're just like, nah, I'm not going to do that, right? I'm just going
to. Well, we've gotten so used to not participating. And that is a real, real risk. You know, we've gotten so used to staying at home, being on our tech, and we're not participating in society in the same way. Like, I hauled a table out into the sidewalk the other day and sold muffins with my daughter. And right. And we're kind of in this, you know, low income neighborhood, and like nobody does stuff like this. But a whole bunch of people came over. They're like, hey, we just wanted to say hi. Who are you? And you're from Canada. They loved it because it's not typical anymore. I mean, it is a bit more typical in a neighborhood like this, but we've become isolated. Right. And we're not participating, and we're not giving each other the benefit of being able to have a discussion, because most people won't be rude to each other in person. They'll rip each other's eyeballs out on social media. But Canadians are dignified people. They're not going to be rude to each other when we're there. We're standing in the grocery store. It's like, OK, you know, I got a kid, you got a kid. We're mostly very dignified, respectful people. But I think the reason why I was able to to do that. And from the beginning was, I've been a photographer for 30 years and I spent a lot of time sitting and waiting for the shot, you know, looking, like really looking at things, watching, looking, seeing. And it's just part of being a photographer and getting a good shot, or walking around the back of it and seeing what it looks like from the back of it to get a different perspective. And it's just a skill and a mindset and what's in my brain. So I was, every single day I would go out and do what I call témoignage, which is to bear witness. And almost every single time I went to go and research something, I realized the government was lying on television. What they were saying was not true, because I would go out. I went to 5 hospitals. None of them were overloaded. Nobody even knew that the people on the TV were saying the hospitals were full. They did. There was no connection. It wasn't actually happening in real life. It was a story. It was the Truman Show, and everybody was just watching it on television. And that was the beauty of the success of what they did to us. They literally kept everybody inside for months. I mean, it was brilliant what they did. It was bad. I'm not saying it was good, but it worked.
No. It dangerously worked. Like, yes. You know, when you talk about selling muffins, we had a garage sale out front of our place earlier this spring, and the amount of people that came out to it was absolutely ludicrous. Yeah. In such a great way. And you go, oh, people have been waiting to get out of their house. Holy Mackinac. Like, yeah. I didn't, you know, neighbors, we've lived in our spot for going on 6 years, I think. And it's sad to say, you don't know your neighbors as well as you probably should, especially coming from a rural background where that's what you did. But like you say, as time speeds up, we do less of that than more of it. And to do things like that really shows the human connection and how everybody's thriving for it. Like they want it.
They're hungry for it, right? And that's what I think the propulsion, I guess is the right word, of where the movement needs to go now is to get people outside again and talking again. You don't have to agree. It's not about agreeing, like do whatever you want, but just reconnecting society. That's what it means, right? To be social. And we've become an incredibly unsocial. I was watching an ad for the Meta Universe, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's yes. Meta, whatever.
Yes.
God, is that stuff disturbing? It's like you can experience real life and touch real plants and stuff. And I was like, or you could just go outside and touch real plants. We're being conditioned to move away from a natural social lifestyle. And many of us, it's too late for me. I'm too old to fall for that stuff probably. And I like all the old stuff. And you go to different cultures and they will never do it. A lot of the cultures that said no to the lockdowns, the African countries that said no, and then their presidents were assassinated. I don't know if you know about that. 4 of them were assassinated, stuff like that. But they went after the Anglosphere countries. And that's a whole other part of the book, if you want to talk about it later. They went after specifically for financial reasons, the European bankers. They went after Canada, Australia, England, and Australia because of financial hegemony. And so now it makes sense why we were all targeted in such a big way. And a lot of the other countries were left alone.
Well, no, you bring it up. Let's talk about it. Could you maybe just fill in the audience on what exactly you're talking about when it comes to financial incentives on you know, Canada, Australia, well, like you said, the Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah, so I studied foreign policy and all that at Queen's, and so I was more used to those conversations. I wasn't really doing health advocacy. And I know a lot about how that world works, and I've worked in it, and I've been in these meetings, and I worked in Brussels and stuff like that. And so the Anglosphere is how the English Commonwealth economy can dominate the world. And there's 2.5 billion people that live in the Anglosphere Commonwealth that's run by the City of London and Britain and the royal family, right? And for whatever, good people, not good people, whatever you want to think, that's the Anglosphere. And the European economies and the EU and that 350 million people that live in those 27 countries are not the Anglosphere. And so there's always been this competition between those two economies. And the main question that I started asking after a few months, and you may have a different theory on this, is, so why March 2020? Why not March 2021? Why not 2019? Why not November? Why not August? Like, why March and April of 2021? Those big, huge things like that don't typically happen without something happening before it to cause them. So something caused it to happen. And I started researching that. And the only major significant event I could come up with was Brexit. And Brexit was signed and went into effect in February of 2020. And the European economy, the European banksters in Brussels and that whole world, they really didn't think it was going to happen. They thought it was going to happen slower. There was a huge amount of defense and intelligence and military contracts tied up in Brexit. And Britain just went slice. They just sliced it all off with Boris. And that's what I think triggered COVID, that the European banking cartels that really still do run the world, and the IMF and the Bank of Settlements and all the colonial loans and stuff like that, who can just pull the carpet out of economy the way they did with Greece. They said, okay, screw you then. And they launched COVID. And that's why I think that's why we saw so much happening in Italy. They used Italy because Italy is the one of the centers of those banking systems. And that's where the guy that just resigned, the prime minister, Mario Draghi, he used to run the European Central Bank until a couple of years ago. And so then I started looking at it through that perspective, and it made sense. And so they were targeting to punish the Anglosphere economy because Europe is broke and they stole all the money. They stole all the pensions. There's nothing. And the euro is collapsing now. And so then it started to make sense. I was like, okay, that's why they would do all this. I mean, the pharmaceutical thing, you add that on top, that's a whole other thing. That's the genocide part. But why did they mess up all of the Anglosphere economies? Why did they lock down the economies of the English-speaking world? And when you start to see it more specifically like that, it was punishment and it was to structurally downgrade us. And then they lent us a whole bunch of money. The EU borrowed $850 billion. The current chancellor brought it in through Angela Merkel. He said, let's bring in $850 billion into the EU to run the pandemic. And they ran it. It was an exercise. It was a simulation. And it came to Canada. And it was to structurally downgrade all of our economies, which has happened now. And that's the biggest crime of all. It is a form of war crime. It's a crimes against humanity of economic nature. And now you can kind of see it. It all adds up and it all makes sense. And the war in Ukraine makes sense. And this huge amount of money that Trudeau is transferring, he's stealing from us and transferring out of our country into the hands of huge, powerful shareholders. What on earth does that have to do with the virus, right? It's always about money, no matter what, these big things. And you know that it's always about money. And so when you start looking at the money, you go in the back door and you go into where the bankers are talking. I'll tell you one more quick little bit because you may want to move the conversation on. But I got a lot of intel from whistleblowers. And a guy told me that the guys that used to run Canadian Housing and Mortgage Corporation, or Canadian Mortgage and Housing, CMHC, walked into Trudeau's office when Bill Morneau was still there. And he was the first resignation, if you remember that. He resigned in the summer of 2020, finance minister. And they said, we know what you're doing. We know exactly what you're doing. You're going to collapse the economy and you're going to collapse the property market. We're not leaving your office until you give us $40 billion. And they gave it to them. That's a whistleblower tip that I got. I don't know if it's true or not, but it was someone who called me from Ottawa. And I was like, wow, that was like February, March of 2020. They knew all the high profile ministers or private, Crown Corporation executives and stuff. They all knew exactly what was about to happen, exactly what Trudeau was going to do. He was going to destroy the economy. And that's what he has done in the past 2 years.
So, and that's to the common person, Susan, how do we get out of this then?
That is the greatest opportunity we have now. And hopefully people will see that when they read this. There's a lot of optimism in this, that thank God it happened when it did, because it might still be looming or we might not have noticed it. Thank God they were so greedy. Thank God they were so sloppy, right? Thank God people like me picked up on it, because now we have the opportunity to rebuild our country. And we've got millions of Canadians who are like starting podcasts and going into Ottawa and running for office. These guys are running scared now because they've started a true revolution. We finally have the equivalent of maybe what was the American Revolution, kicking out the Brits for the Americans. We finally have Canadians now rising up and doing that, but they're doing that in a way that they're doing it in a way that is dignified and respectful and intellectual, and it's going to happen more slowly. But wait until like 10 years from now, we're not going to recognize Canada. It is going to be so much better than it ever was. It may still be a little hard and bumpy on the way, but there's stuff going on now that nobody dreamed about doing 2 years ago.
I appreciate the optimism. There's a lot of people that focus on the negatives and never on some of the positives that are going to come out of this, and truly do enjoy when somebody can look at the future and see good things on the horizon. What's some of the things that excite you then about Canada? Because you brought up you're in the UK, you're sitting over there watching what's going on. What are some of the things you think are you know, look to be beneficial? Maybe as all of us Canadians sit here and can't see 2 feet in front of our face, what are some things that stick out to you, Susan, that you think could be better for us here in the near future?
Okay, well, probably because I am so connected because I've been doing this from the beginning. I may get a lot more information than most people, right? I'm getting it all over the place constantly. And I'm actively involved in quite a bit of it. So I guess the big broad strokes are now we have major lawsuits happening and we're winning. That's a good sign, right? It's finally hitting the courts and the judges are ruling, like Tamara Leach getting out, the $10 million Ontario Physicians and Surgeons lawsuit. There's 7 lawsuits now against mine. So litigation and the judiciary, that is functioning again, and we will win even more there. So that's good. We have, parents and households and mothers and children and fathers redesigning education and school and food. They're actively just saying, okay, I'm going to grow a food garden. I'm going to open a school. And that's the beginning of a long road for them. But those physical changes, those are hugely transformational for societies over 10 or 20 years. So that's a good thing. What you're doing, and people like Laura Lynn and Odessa and Western Standard, whatever, we're building a new media industry and we're going to have all the money in 5 years. That will happen. I don't know if you're old enough to remember when CNN started. I remember when CNN started, right? They had nothing and no money. And everyone was like, oh yeah, right. 24-hour news. Who's going to watch that? So that will happen for us media. But I think the best part about it all is that Canadians are taking back the basic premise that we're sovereign beings with rights and the government works for us. And that was the hardest thing to see people hand that over and say, well, I'll just do what the government's telling me to do. I'm just going to follow what the government says. And I was like, oh my God, worst decision ever. And now more people, and I get lots of emails from quiet, humble, simple women who are scared or whatever. And they're like, I spoke up at my school meeting. I put something on the bulletin board at work. Like the littlest, tiniest little seeds are being planted. People are realizing that we are authentically sovereign beings who have far more rights that any government has the authority to rule over us. And that will be the big long-term win, that we could get to a more sovereign mindset. You know, and that's why what you do is so important. It's about changing the mindset of Canadians to be more fierce and more protective of what belongs to us rightly. And we didn't have that in the past 50 years. So you look at a culture like, I don't know what would be, maybe Russia is not the right example, but Spain or some of the Eastern European countries, and they're way more fierce. The South America countries, the ones that have been screwed over, or the Americans, right? That's what we need to get to. We need to get to a more fierce, a more, I would say nationalistic, but a more citizen-based, citizen-ruled society where the citizens call the shots and we tell the government what to do because they are our servants and they are our employees.
Yeah, and I hope one of the things that I've maybe done well on this is I don't think it's ever, when you go back to those early days, and for me, they were later than yours, but made a lot of people uncomfortable, a lot of people upset. And I remember just, sitting in a room and going, maybe I should stop, I'm like, what am I doing wrong? I'm literally asking questions from people who know more than I do. I don't know if there's anything wrong with that. I have to trust that majority of people are willing to listen to something and not buy everything hook, line, and sinker. Heck, that's why they're listening to me, is because they're not watching the news, right? They're coming and listening to something where I'm like, I actually say, like, by all means, question the crap out of me, question the crap out of my guests, think for yourself, do some reading, like improve, but never be ashamed to ask questions. And I hope that's what the alternative form of media is doing, is empowering people to, like, it's okay to ask questions. If at any time that isn't the case, that's a warning sign. right? Like, you're not allowed to ask questions.
Ooh. Yeah, and even more so than that, that let's make it, and this is why I took a lot of flack, and I knew this would happen from the beginning because I have a public relations background, but I used myself as that banner. I positioned myself as the poster child mom who's going to stand up and scream with a megaphone and call out the government. And I knew the blowback would be big. But I knew that I could eventually win if I kept going and people would go, well, wait a minute. I kind of like what she said there. Well, wait a minute. She has a university degree. Okay, wait a minute. You know, she drives a Volvo. Like all these other pieces would come because I'm just I'm a good, honest, hardworking Canadian person. I'm just like everybody else. And that's where I think we need to take it more is we need to make it like everybody's been watching TikTok thinking, how can I be like Kim Kardashian? I want everybody to read books like mine and listen to podcasts like yours or Odessa's and want to be like her or yeah. you or me, you know, want to be tough, want to be smart. And we've been really dumbed down. And you may not know this because of our age differences, but I used to sit around the dinner table three times a day almost with my family. And we would have intellectual discussions and we're not some big intellectual family. That's just the way it was. You sat there and you talked about things and you talked to my father taught me about Lebanon and all the stuff that was going on in the 70s. And we just talked about it. It's the way families live. And we've really dumbed ourselves down. So I'm hoping that that will change. And that's where I'm going now is really building a culture of chicness and aspiration for the influencers of Canada to take this on and make whistleblowing and in a polite way. Holding government officials accountable, making it like the thing to do.
Well, I tell you what, in March, we had the first ever SMP Presents Solutions for the Future. I brought a lawyer, a doctor, media personality who's now running to be the premier of Alberta. That was Danielle Smith. And then an MLA from Alberta. The four, I brought them all in. They got to talk. And then we sat them down in a roundtable format and just discussed in front of a live audience with their questions some of the problems we were facing and had faced through COVID. And before the event went, I was scared shitless because I was like, what if this is terrible? Because it could be. It's literally people talking and I don't know if people are going to enjoy this or not as I do a podcast, right? And the engagement from the audience was really, really cool. Like really cool. I was like, wow. Okay. People want to continue to learn. So one of the things going on right now, you know, I can't figure out politics. All I know is I can't figure out, you know, if I'm doing it the right way or not, but they got this leadership debate going on or race here in Alberta. So I've just started having them all on. And next week, Monday, I'm in Vermilion to help panel another discussion of some of the people running for it. And I'm extremely excited about it. Mainly, Susan, because I believe that we haven't been paying attention. And when you don't pay attention, people kind of just get to go through the motions. And I'm not saying everybody in politics is that way. I'm just mean in general, if nobody in the you know public cares about what you're doing, are you going to be held to a high standard or not, right? And by focusing on it, I hope more people are starting to pay attention to it because I certainly am. And if there's a ton of people like me, I feel like there's a ton more people starting to pay attention. Now, whether that changes everything, I have no idea. But after this year, I won't be fooled when somebody gets on stage and says I can change the world because we're going to have our eyes opened or not here in the next little bit with all these candidates running after one of the premiers steps aside. And you have them all saying similar things on how they need to do things to get Alberta and the people here to trust back in a government. And I'm really intrigued to see where it goes, but maybe, you know, a woman with your background, maybe I just sound foolhardy. I don't know if I'm.
No, you're completely right. And the most important thing is raising the level of the quality of the conversation. And it's not about people being, well, I'm educated and I'm smart and intellectual. It's not about that. It's about being a person, and you can do this because your skill set and your tech background and your tools and your resources, fine. And I'm good at this, and I would enjoy doing this on stage and big events and stuff like that because I have some big skills around this because of my TV background. When we are in the presence of someone who knows how to moderate a really interesting intellectual discussion and not one that shames people, that a kid who's 19 and comes from a poor background and speaks like a trucker still can stand up and contribute an idea, and everybody else in the room respects that and the conversation going. So if you've ever been around that kind of event, true intellectual, intelligent discussion, there is nothing more exciting. That people love that stuff. And we used to have that in the 70s. I'm not trying to say the 70s was perfect, but we used to have that in Canada. Now we have this awful naming, shaming. Like,
well, then I think it's going to make a resurgence.
He does it. Yeah. And that you can facilitate that, and we can all facilitate that. And people are hungry for it, because this is the main dynamic that connects humanity to one another, is discussion. The number of times that I've started a discussion around this kind of stuff, and before I know it, there's 20 people in the circle. People will literally come across the street. That's why I did the muffin thing. It was just to get people to meet us and to have discussion. So many people are happy to participate, but they're not going to start it. And so you're the one that can start it. You got the microphone, you got the broadcast, you can do that. You could become, and not that this may not be your goal or whatever, but people like you could really be a huge influence on where Canada goes intellectually. And that will save us, because it doesn't matter if people agree. It doesn't matter if you like purple or you're gay or you want to drive an electric car, whatever. None of that stuff matters. The most important thing that matters is that we look out for each other and we have a kind, peaceful, respectful society. Those are the societies where the biggest wins are. And those are the societies, ironically, too, where the highest levels of health are and wealth. When you see high levels of health and wealth, you see high levels of compassion and respect. And that's what Canada, that's the double sword of how we're going down. The less we allow people intellectual debate and freedom, the worse we get financially and health-wise. It's all happened. It's the same collapse. You know, it's the same things that collapse the building. When you allow people to be free, Christy Noem talks about this in South Dakota very eloquently, or North Dakota, wherever she's governor. When you allow people the freedom to take care of themselves and you give them the resources to take care of their families and have employment, whatever, they figure everything else out. They save their money. They eat apples. They generally, most of the population heads upwards in terms of broad-based wealth and health. It's when you bring in big systems and rules and autocracy that everything starts to go downhill. And so until we get rid of Trudeau, we're never going to break the cycle, because he is not about true upliftment. He is about authoritarianism. And yeah, he speaks like it, right? The way he says, let me be very clear on this.
Yeah, I think his days are numbered myself. I mean, but in saying that, he's still got a lot of days as prime minister, especially, making the pact with the NDP to form the government for, you know, till 2025. I mean, we all know that isn't going anywhere anytime soon, but it is going somewhere. You know, 2025 is coming. I just can't see it. Everything he's done to this point has made Canada not a good, like, everybody, you talk about the spears are out. Like, the us versus them rhetoric has been something I never thought I would see here. Everybody's in Canada, you know, for my entire life has always been about peace and love and harmony and you know, kind of just like almost like a fiction novel of, you know, not utopia, because that's not what it was. And certainly there's been some problems, but overall, to treat one another with respect. And then you get going through COVID, you get all of our leaders, from premiers to the prime minister, saying it's us versus them and screw them.
Yeah.
And that filtered down to a ton of people. It's taken time to slowly unravel that onion and really get past it. And it's going to take more time. Like, it ain't over yet, you know, but I see a lot of hope. What I'm really hopeful in is I see more people starting to engage in talking with one another. And once you start talking with one another, you can see some things for what they are. Now, is it a quick fix? No. But for a solid year, nobody talked to anyone. Like, literally, no one talked to anyone. I'm thankful every day for this podcast, because it allowed me to go beyond my scope and see and hear from different parts of not only the country, but different countries, and see what was going on and hear that and be like, oh, okay. Like, that gives me some, like, a little bit of encouragement to go muster on 3 more days, and then another 3 days, and another 4 days. And, oh, wait, they just said it's a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Oh, God. Okay. Where are we at today? You know, like, those were tough days. And yet, by talking to people such as yourself, and doctors and lawyers and statisticians and just all walks of life, it's made it better. And I see more and more people starting to do that, which means things will get better, but it takes time.
Yeah, I really believe we're going to look back on this, you know, 10 years from now, or even 20 years from now, and go, oh my God, remember those 2 or 3 years. And it will be like, what's the most appropriate example? I don't want to say the Holocaust or Rwanda, but it will be like, it's like when your jerk boyfriend dumps you and it's so painful, whatever. And then you realize it's actually probably the best thing that ever happened to you, because you learn self-respect that you didn't have before. And that's what we will be as a country, I think, especially if we keep elevating the visionaries and the leaders, the ones who are taking us down the path of kindness and compassion and acceptance. We keep promoting those voices and get Canadians to aspire to that. That's why I worry about some of the social media and this nastiness that goes on, right? That's the last thing we want to do, is go down that road. That's not Canadian at all. And we don't need to go down the racism road, because Canada isn't racist besides what has happened to our Indigenous people, but we're not a racist society at all. So I have great hope, and I really am honored, you know, to have someone like you contact me, because I played a very pivotal role in the beginning, but that was 2 years ago. And I'm doing a whole other thing now that's really important, and it's more of a business move and a lifestyle move. But the stuff that people are doing now, and the traction they're getting, and the views that they're getting on their videos and opportunities, and I'm really excited about that 10-part series, like I was telling you about the Western Standard, that was so not possible 2 years ago. You have no idea how brutal it was. And maybe I'll come on another time and tell you how hard it was for us in the first 6 months. I mean, we literally had rocks thrown at us.
Hey, Susan, how hard was it for you in the first 6 months?
Unbelievable. I cried every single day. I was insulted. I was thrown under the bus by family. Like, I've never been through something like that. If anybody had told me this is what's going to happen to you, maybe I wouldn't have started the protest. I probably would have, because I was upset. But we didn't have Jordan Peterson saying the stuff he's saying now. We didn't have Julie Parnas. We didn't have James Topp. There was nobody. I mean, there was like a few hundred of us across the country. We had Vlad and Kellyanne were some of the first ones out in the East. I guess Pat King, and he's been doing stuff for years, but we weren't connected. We didn't know each other. None of us knew each other and connected in the same way. And we had a few media stories, but they were mostly awful and targeted us. We had to build up those media voices. We had to support them and raise money for them and watch their podcasts and stuff. We literally had to build it from scratch. But that's how you create a new society, you know. It took the French, 10 years to get rid of their revolution, the major French Revolution, and then the resistance in World War II, another 5 years. Can you imagine working underground for 5 years, smuggling guns and raising money and doing things on ham radios and stuff? I mean, the French did that for years, the resistance. So we'll get there. And I would love to still play a role with women and moms and be a voice of experience. And I'm older, I'm 54. I have a different perspective. But one of the things that I love doing, and I would love to see more people do, but maybe they won't, is connect Canada to the international world and the international world of advocacy over in Europe, in different parts of Africa. There's so much goodwill all over the world for our country. And the more Canadians can get out, people like you, come over here and do podcasts, come and travel. It has an unbelievable impact on justice in our country, because the world starts pointing fingers and start looking more closely at our country. We're very isolated right now. We're in a big media blackout. I don't know if Canadians really understand that, but most of the world is not doing anything what Canada is doing. Most of the governments have stopped everything.
Yeah, I think I can speak for my audience when I say I think we understand it. I don't know if we fully understand it, but like we kind of get it. But I don't think we know how can you know if you don't go to a different country to the full extent of what Canada is still implementing and talking about and trying to do and trying to force until you go somewhere else to experience how they're doing things. So I think majority of my audience fully gets that Canada is somewhere locked in 2020 and doesn't want to, you know, get its hands off that time period.
No, what I mean is the influence that we can have by leaving our borders. to like what I'm doing. I'm actively involved in what's going on in Canada, and I have a unique influence because I am outside the borders and alerting people in different countries. I talk to people from different countries every single day in my community, and they all know what's going on, and then they will tell their friends and they will send an email or whatever. So the external pressure, that's what I mean. That's how apartheid was brought down, was external pressure on the South African government. They couldn't bring it down themselves. They needed the international community to do that. And that's a major tool that we're not accessing. People like Christine Anderson. If we had 100 people like Christine Anderson, we could make so much more progress. You know who she is, right?
Do
you know
I actually is? Don't. No, I'm...
Oh,
I'm...
God. She's the German Member of Parliament. So she's in the European Parliament, who spoke up and told Trudeau that he was not welcome in the European Parliament. And she's a fierce supporter of Canada. And so the influence that she's having on our country, because she's not inside Canada and she speaks from authority, a position of authority, or doctors, or there's law enforcement, there's lawyers over here. They all know what's going on in Canada and they can help us, but we need more Canadians to get out, even if it's just for a trip. I'm not saying do what I do, but come over here for a couple of weeks, come and do your podcast over here with your kids or something. Things like that for people who can. It's a great form of advocacy, is international advocacy.
I now that you mention who and her background, yes, I've seen the videos. I think a lot of people applaud. Well, I know a ton of people applauded. As for coming to the UK, I tell you what, Susan, if I come to the UK, I'm coming to find you. And I'd certainly come do some podcasts. That'd be a ton of fun.
I'll introduce you to all the powerful voices. I know all of them. I know the guy, his name is Mark Sexton. He's the guy that's now pushing for private criminal prosecutions of government employees, the people who are doing the big stuff. And he's one of them, a lawyer in London. There's stuff happening in Ireland as well. I've got contacts there. So I'm serious, or if you know anybody else, and they all are watching Canada. And we're very respected because of our convoy and certain leaders, but we're also very pitied because they know that Canada is one of the hardest hit because of our resources and because of Trudeau.
Well, I tell you what, we can, well, I might have to bug you about some of that. Cause that would be, I think, for not only myself, but the audience, informative to have some different guests on with the background that you probably can supply. I'd be over the moon, honestly, to have some different perspectives come on here and talk about exactly what's going on right now and what they're trying to do and keeping everybody up to date.
Okay, well, count me in. I'll send you a list. I've done this before. I can send you probably 10 really important voices who are doing the actions here, mostly down towards London, right? That's where a lot of it's happening. And their social channels, so you can get connected to them. I'm sure they would be honored to do what I'm doing. They're doing it all the time, and they want to find out who's doing what in Canada too.
Awesome. Well, this has been thoroughly enjoyable. It's nice to finally meet you. We've kind of been dip, dodge, ducking each other, but yeah. Appreciate you coming on here and giving me some of your time. Before I let you go, the final question is always brought to you by Crudemaster, and it is simply, if you're going to stand behind a cause that you think is right, then stand behind it. Absolutely. That was Heath McDonald that said those words. And the question then is, what's one thing Susan stands behind?
Well, that justice is for all of us, and that we can all have a unique influence in our own authentic way. Everybody has a little tiny force of power to move the needle on justice. And history has proved that, and it will always be the case. So get out there and do something.
I appreciate it. Appreciate you giving me some of your time today. And I'm sure we will talk here in the future.
Lovely. Okay, thanks. Bye, everyone. Thanks for having me.